From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Joining me on the show this week are Hillary Krieger, deputy White House editor at Politico, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. And here are the issues. President Obama headed to Asia for back-to-back summits this week. There were some agreements on climate change and trade, but rumbling superpower tensions too. Back in Washington, Republicans are preparing to take control of Congress. What will that mean for foreign policy? The blood-soaked stalemate in Syria deepened, with warnings that neighbours are slamming the doors closed to refugees. And mixed news on the Ebola front in West Africa, where Mali announced new border controls, even as Liberia lifted some safety measures. So let's start with President Obama. So, you know, he sort of didn't escape from the lame duck thing pretty quickly. I mean, and classically, second-term presidents always take foreign policy as a bit of a sort of way out when they're frustrated at home. And sure enough, within 24 hours of his sort of shellacking in the midterm elections, he was on Air Force One, heading for really back-to-back summits. So, Hillary, there were some deals. There were some, since these deals were not as sort of significant as they might have been. But overall, did a lame duck president of America travel to Asia? Or is there a sense that if you're the American president, and actually the American economy is going pretty well, you know, once you get abroad, you're still a big figure and doing pretty well? What was the kind of mood around Obama this week?
I think, you know, in the international scene, he's the president of the United States. He's still the one that they have to do business with. A lot of people who are, you know, in international countries that need U.S. support look to the United States, can't wait 2 years to sit around, and they know he's the one that they have to deal with now. At the same time, they see him as a diminished figure. So not only is he a lame duck, but his party just lost really big, and that makes him look like somebody who can't, you know, deliver things that he's supposed to be able to deliver.
And you saw some sneering commentaries in the Chinese state media about,
exactly,
you know, look how messy democracy is and his, you know, how weak this is, because they like to spread the message that democracy is a messy thing. But he got some, you know, some agreements. So the White House was trumpeting an agreement between America and China to work on their own together towards climate change goals. Is the sense that there's a lot there, or that there's sort of not quite as much in there as meets the eye?
Well, I think there's the big picture, which is that actually is quite significant. I mean, this is something that the U.S. has wanted to see and other global players have wanted to see for a long time. China has been seen as the big stumbling block in moving forward on setting targets for greenhouse gas emissions, and that just simply by coming out with these statements, it puts a lot of pressure on everybody else to take action as well. The fact that Obama, first of all, successfully laid the groundwork, it shows that he can get the diplomatic game right occasionally. He's mm-hmm. looked like he's stumbled in a lot of other arenas, so just a sense of competence was actually
and
important.
And they've invested a gigantic amount of work in this China relationship.
Right, right. And the so-called pivot to Asia hasn't necessarily had a lot to show for it. This gives it, you know, a sign that it's on the right track, that they are getting results. And the fact, actually, that it took place at a joint meeting between Obama and Xi, that's also significant, because usually China, when it has done stuff, it has wanted to make it entirely on its own, very independent, because of China deciding, not in any sign of it being because of U.S. pressure or because of a multinational image issue. And so the fact that Obama was successful in getting this to happen where he needed it, when he needed it, it projects a lot about the U.S. on the world stage and the importance of that. The details, however, are another question, because certainly the U.S. has to do a lot more upfront than China, and there's a lot of room for people to mm-hmm. be critical. There aren't necessarily legally binding steps, so it's not clear what'll happen. So, but I think when you look at the broad scope of it, it is very significant and mm-hmm. shouldn't be diminished.
Tom DeFrank, you have been covering White Houses for decades, you know, one of the most experienced White House watchers in Washington. You've seen presidents in this sort of lame duck moment before. Looking at President Obama, looking at the reception that he got from these other Asia leaders, also the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, there, did you feel that this was a president kind of on the out, or that I mean, how does he compare to previous presidents?
In these sorts of circumstances, probably a little more diminished than most. So basically, the last 2 years of a president's second term, any president, even one riding high, is captive by the clock. His political adversaries, his geopolitical interlocutors, if they wish, can just run out the clock and say, we're not going to move on this, whatever this is, until we see who the next president is. So that hurts him a little bit, but I agree absolutely with Hillary. What is India going to do now that the world's largest polluter, China, has in effect said greenhouse gases and climate change are real and are important? I think it also undermines to a certain extent the deniers, especially in the United States Congress. There are a couple of Republican senators who say the whole notion of climate change and greenhouse gases is a hoax.
One of whom is now the chairman of the Senate Environment Committee,
which is one for the history books, I think. Not exactly a Renaissance man from Oklahoma named Senator James Inhofe. But anyway, I think this shows that a president, even a diminished president, heading towards the sunset, is still the leader of the free world, even if he's diminished. On the other hand, of course, we see that as he's sitting down with Vladimir Putin, the Russians are sending troops and more heavy weapons into Ukraine. So that was kind of a thumb in the eye as well. So it's a mixed thing for him.
But let's flip that on its head, because everything you've said is absolutely convincing. But there is a sort of counter-argument, if you're an optimist, isn't there, which is that absolutely the clock is ticking. You know, the lame duck thing cannot be, you know, wished away. On the other hand, if you only have 2 years left and you don't have to face voters ever again and you are very keen to have a legacy, that's when you can possibly get some stuff done. And we've seen, you know, President Clinton somehow redeemed some of the sort of the horrors of the Monica Lewinsky impeachment scandal by, you know, doing big things in foreign policy, you know, really grappling with the Balkan horrors and particularly at the end of, you know, the two terms. George W. Bush, let's not forget, the final 2 years of his time as White House, you know, although, you know, so many people around the world were furious about the Iraq war, and he did have the best 2 years of foreign policy were his last 2 years, because he changed his team and he took risks and he changed his tone, and you know, people who dealt with him government to government, they definitely noticed a change, even if maybe public opinion around the world was sort of done with him. Is there a kind of positive side?
Yes, no, there's definitely a positive side, except for treaties, which have to be ratified by the United States Senate. A president more or less has a free hand in the conduct of foreign policy, essentially impervious to congressional scrutiny.
And I'm keen to get into the congressional stuff in the next segment, but I'm just very keen to ask about this question of, you know, are there things that he could get done on trade, for example? You know, there's these two very large international trade pacts that President Obama says he wants to get done, one with 11 other nations in Asia, one with the entire European Union. His own party, the Democrats, they're not always convinced by the idea of free trade, particularly their allies in the labor unions. Do we see a kind of window where maybe he can take some risks, this very cautious president?
Right. I mean, I think you are seeing already some of the gloves coming off with him, that he has been risk averse throughout much of his presidency. And yet already in these, you know, couple of weeks since the midterms, you have him striking a climate deal, which has a certain amount of controversy around it. You see him putting out a very strong statement on net neutrality in terms of internet rules that he has refrained from weighing into. He's staking his ground and saying, I'm going to fight for this. He's said on immigration, when Republicans have warned him against taking executive actions, that he's going ahead with it regardless of the consequences. So I absolutely think that he is shifting to taking advantage of this opportunity and being freed from an electoral process to do that. I think on the trade front, he actually, ironically, faces a better environment because the Democrats lost the Senate. Mm-hmm. Republicans are much more interested in seeing these PACs approved. And it's been Harry Reid, the head of the Democrats in the Senate, who's really held up a lot of the process of fast-tracking these agreements so they have a better chance of going through, for instance. So I actually think he faces a better environment with Republicans on that front and a couple of other policy areas.
It's also, I have to say, having been based in China as a correspondent before, the Chinese have this strange habit of they like American presidents who they've kind of house-trained. The thing that the Chinese never like is new presidents, because when they have new presidents, they know that new presidents like to kind of talk about human rights and cause them difficulties and say how they're going to be tough on China, what an awful country. By the time they get the president kind of, you know, good and house-trained, they like him. They don't like changes. So they'll be reasonably happy to deal with this kind of lame duck.
Like Hillary Clinton if by chance she becomes the next president?
They're very cynical about, you know, they tend to prefer Republicans because they think that business is what gets them through. But, you know, they take the view that people come, they arrive, they shout, they bluster, and they get them house-trained after a couple of years.
That's you see with the Hong Kong protests going on right now that Obama had a pretty big stage where he could have made that
exactly.
a big part of what he was saying and doing. And it was only when reporters asked him that he's weighed in at all on this issue over many months.
And Tom DeFrank, I mean, let's look at that while we're sort of finishing up on Asia. That idea of Barack Obama, the idealist, Barack Obama, the president who was the anti-Bush, the president who was handed a Nobel Peace Prize more or less as he walked into work the first day for being not George Bush. How does he look now? So he doesn't talk much about Hong Kong. He goes to Myanmar. He's just had meetings with Aung San Suu Kyi, the great hero of the democracy movement in Burma, in Myanmar. He could have said some very strong things about how it's an outrage that they've basically rewritten the constitution to exclude her from ever becoming president. How does he look now, this idealistic pro-democracy president in his last 2 years?
He looks, on this score, he looks especially diminished. You're right. He gave the Chinese a pass on Hong Kong. And having been in Hong Kong talking to protesters 3 weeks ago and following up with some of them in the last few days, I can tell you they are none too pleased with the president of the United States. They feel like he let them down. But he's practicing realpolitik, I think, and maybe it was inevitable, but he's I think he now wants to look like he can play the game more than he can fly the flag.
And I guess in his defense on Hong Kong, he is facing a Chinese state media which is saying the Hong Kong democracy process are all being organized secretly by the Americans. So there is always a sense that an American leader is kind of, you know, he's damned if he does, damned if he doesn't, because if he speaks out too much.
Right.
Now, Hillary, you raised some fascinating points about how Congress, and Tom as well, how will this new Republican-controlled Congress, where the Republicans have control of both halves, both the Senate and the House of Representatives, so he really is, you know, an isolated Democratic White House facing an entirely Republican-controlled Congress. Now, the rules of the game are that the president has pretty sweeping foreign policy powers, but nonetheless, Congress was given some pretty handy ways to clip a president's wings by the founding fathers. So, Tom, what do we think that a Republican-controlled Senate, particularly perhaps with their kind of confirmation powers and their treaty powers, what will they do to foreign policy these last 2 years?
Well, I think they're going to have a much more decisive impact than the Republicans had in the minority in the Senate. Some of it is psychological. The new chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee is going to be Senator John McCain, who is no fan of President Obama, especially he thinks President Obama's policy in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria is an unmitigated disaster, and he will use his perch as chairman of the Armed Services Committee to haul up senior generals and admirals and put them under oath and ask them, you know, how long they think it's going to take to stabilize things in that part of the world. McCain will take the opportunity to embarrass President Obama at every turn, and the other Republicans will do exactly the same. Again, you're right. Any president has sweeping powers to conduct foreign policy, and unless it's a treaty, which must be, as I said earlier, which must be ratified by the Senate, the president is pretty unfettered. On the other hand, the Republican-dominated Senate can defund, can deny him funds for some of the things he wants to do. So I think the opportunity for mischief, depending on your political point of view, is high and large.
Now, Hillary Krieger of Politico, we have at least one foreign policy deadline coming up soon on November the 24th. They have the agreement with Iran, the interim deal with Iran to try and stop or slow Iran's supposed nuclear weapons program. That has to be extended. Congress has already made pretty clear that they don't really trust this president to do a tough enough deal. They think he's capable of doing a kind of soft deal to just get any deal done with Iran. There are some things Congress can do to try and curb his ability to kind of, say, ease sanctions, for example. Congress can make life pretty difficult for him, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, actually, in many of these cases, the challenge a president has is to get Congress to act. He wants to have something affirmative happen, like money going to a certain armed cause, for instance, and he has to convince Congress to do that. In this case, he faces a bit of a different challenge. He actually wants to have certain laws that are on the books taken off. And in that case, you know, these Republicans have absolutely no interest in taking these sanctions laws and watering them down or removing them.
And now the Republicans would say, you know, the president is offering to Iran, I will ease some of these tough sanctions that are hurting your economy if you do this and this. The Republicans are saying, you know what, actually us being tougher than him, there's a good cop, bad cop dynamic. We could actually be rather helpful here. He should thank us for making his life this difficult. Tom, well, do you think President Obama is going to thank Congress if they say, actually, we're not going to let you lift those sanctions on Iran?
I don't think so, no. I mean, I think the president doesn't like Congress. Republican-dominated Congress does not like him. The bad blood is the worst I can ever remember in almost 50 years of watching these sorts of things. And so I've got a bad feeling generically about what's happening, how the relationship will go. But I think you're right. Occasionally there could be a good cop, bad cop situation that might be useful to the president.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie of The Economist. Joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and Hillary Krieger of Politico. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issuesinthenews. Hillary Krieger, talk to us about Israel and the Middle East as well. That's something that Congress has very, very strong views on. How will a Republican-controlled Congress complicate the president's already pretty terrible relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of what the Congress can do, as Tom was saying, is sort of cause mischief, is raise issues, you know, bring in people to testify that go against the president's policy and otherwise, you know, use their bully pulpit to disagree with him and try to box them into a corner. They have less ability to impact exactly the policy that's going on. So I think when you're looking at what happens in terms of Israel, Republicans are very sympathetic to Israel. They have very close ties with Netanyahu. And so Netanyahu has always sort of tried to play off the Republicans against, you know, a Democratic administration. And I think now that the Republicans are even stronger in Congress, he's going to just be even less inclined to see Obama as somebody he has to deal with, thinking that he can go to the Republicans in Congress and get the money that he wants for Israel aid, for instance, that if the Palestinians are doing things that he's opposed to, he can go to Republicans in Congress and have them shut off funding to Palestinians to force them to take certain steps. So I think you're just going to continue to see Obama and Netanyahu parting ways as Netanyahu goes to allies that he has in Congress.
Now, Tom DeFrank, we have actually, you know, we do know that in some circumstances, the president is going to ask Congress to give him permission to do some important things. So he's already asking for little bits of money here and there for the fight against Islamic State, the fanatics fighting in Syria and Iraq. He's also asked, perhaps in the sort of longer term, to give him a new legal basis for going to war at all, because we're still using this incredibly kind of flimsy legal basis passed a couple of days after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. But looking at Syria, where we saw some terrible news earlier this week in terms of, you know, evidence that the borders are basically closing on Syria, that people who want to get out of Syria are no longer able to flee. I mean, it is true that the neighbors have taken a tremendous number of refugees. So there's a sense that kind of the prison gates are closing on Syria. Does President Obama have to go to Congress to get permission to do more in Syria? And will Congress push him to do more?
Some will. Senator McCain, who has long been an advocate of a more robust, more muscular Syrian policy, and who's still angry that 18 months ago President Obama said he was going to go into Syria and never did. The Syria hawks will push him, but there is also a political component here that says we don't want to get involved in a land war in Asia or in the Middle East, and look what's happened in Iraq twice and Afghanistan. And so there's going to be a lot of maneuvering here. But basically, if the president says it's a matter of American national security that I need $300 million more to do this, that, and the other, I think it's going to be hard even for Republicans who don't like him to deny him that kind of money.
And again, I think this is a place where Republicans have actually typically been more supportive of money for military actions in Syria, who've pushed him to take a harder line, who are, you know, much more likely to approve an authorization for military force. So he actually could have, in some ways, an easier go of it. The rhetoric will be worse, but in terms of actually getting through what he needs to get through, it might be easier for him than it was under Democrats.
And Hillary Krieger, you cover the White House. You're there. I mean, is there a sense that things are sort of moving quite fast on that? I mean, if you remember back only a few months ago, it was absolutely the conventional wisdom. Everybody knew that there could never again be American boots on the ground in the Middle East. And everybody knew that the American public, above anything else, did not want more troops and more war in the Middle East. But suddenly we're seeing top generals talking about they might have to have American troops fighting alongside Iraqi forces. Tell me about how it feels in the White House. Do people sort of know the strategy hasn't changed? Everyone is incredibly confident. We know exactly what we're doing. Or how does it feel on that fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria?
I don't think there's a sense of like staggering success, and that, you know, in fact, it's quite the opposite, that person after person has come to has come to the White House to say you need to do something. And it started out with Republican hawks like McCain, and then it got to Democratic hawks, and then it gets to within the circle of people who Obama have had working with him, who are, you know, more traditional Democrats, saying you have to do something. And this sort of drumbeat has really forced the president to grapple and reevaluate. And that's why you saw finally, you know, willingness to take some military action against the Islamic State. And since that has not been hugely successful, and you're now hearing, you know, these generals within his own administration, so to speak, saying these things, it just continues that pressure. And I think there's just a constant process of trying, searching for something to get a hold on what's happening. And I think you see a continual erosion of a sense of confidence.
And Tom, tell us about this, you know, American generals asking their president to be tough. Now, you know, in the outside world, people might think, well, of course, generals want to be tough. But actually, post the Vietnam War, American generals have been some of the most cautious voices in Washington, haven't they?
Right. I think the high water mark of American generals getting their way was when General Westmoreland, who was commanding U.S. troops in then South Vietnam, asked for another 206,000 troops from President Johnson, and he got it. And I think that those days are over. But I'm going to put my cynic's hat on here just for a moment, David. I do not believe for a moment that it was sheer coincidence that the announcement that we were going to send a few thousand more American troops into Iraq and ultimately into Syria came 10 days after the election. I think they knew this was coming. I think the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, other commanders, commander of the Central Command that has tactical operational authority over this area of the world, they knew that 1,500 troops was insufficient, and the White House knew that was insufficient. I think they delayed this because they, meaning the White House political team, they delayed this announcement because they knew that the left, the president's political base, would be irritated. And so I agree with Hillary that it's a very fluid situation, and they're trying to adapt to the situation on the ground, which is not going very well. And so there is some fluidity to this dynamic. But I think it's been a foregone conclusion for weeks, at least, that we're going to need more troops, not fewer. And I think we're going to see more deployments in the months ahead.
Yeah. And Hillary, I mean, here's one of the questions, I guess. If you look at, say, Syria, the strategy is now very belatedly to find moderate Syrian rebels and arm them and train them. Is there a sense that there are lots of rebels available to do that? I mean, are we too late?
I think there's a very good case to be made that the U.S. is way, way, way too late. Obviously, this is still playing out. And, you know, the rebels have been saying that they really need certain things, and maybe those things would be such a catalyst to finally get them that it could change the dynamic. But I remember sitting in this very room in the studio talking, you know, maybe a couple of years ago about advances that rebels were making and how it really looked like they were on the ascendancy and they had control of such important territories and airports. And I mean, there were opportunities to take advantage of those moments. Now you have a situation where the rebels that are strong are the Islamic State, which the United States is now fighting against, putting it on the same side as President Bashar al-Assad. The opening that you might have enough people on the ground who still somehow align with American interests to make a substantive difference, it's very, very hard to see where that is.
David, a couple of days ago, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel said that the structure is now in place for the training of moderate Syrian forces in Saudi Arabia and other places. The structure is in place. And then he said, or one of his generals said, we're talking 8 to 12 months here before we can train them. The notion that ISIS is going to sit still and, mm-hmm. and won't, or it will be a manageable problem for 8 to 12 months, strains the mind.
It would be comic if it weren't tragic. Well, I don't want to send listeners into the weekend in a sort of state of catatonic despair. So there are sparks of good news from West Africa, where at least some of the countries that were really under the grip of the Ebola virus are saying they can actually lift some of the restrictions. Liberia is lifting its state of emergency, reopening markets. Hillary, is it all good news, all bad news? How do we think it's looking in Africa with Ebola?
I mean, I don't think when you put Africa and Ebola together in the same sentence, you can really come up with like a great news sense from that. You still have a huge, huge problem, and you still have new cases, and, you know,
Mali's opening, has got border control.
Exactly.
A couple of cases in
exactly.
Mali.
Exactly. But, you know, you have seen countries declare themselves Ebola-free, and you've had successes in the United States that show that there are mm-hmm. ways to deal with this medically, and now you're seeing that those advances being brought over to Africa. And also you're seeing, you know, American aid, which, again, we talk about timing and is it mm-hmm. too late? You know, there are people who were tracking this disease a few months ago saying, hey, the U.S. really needs to be spending money and get invested. And the U.S. took a pretty hands-off approach. And that's shifted. And that makes a difference, too.
Well, the fact that the U.S. military is now going to send 3,000 troops, not the 4,000 they thought they needed, suggests that there is more. While there's still a lot to do with the medical infrastructure, there's better medical infrastructure in some of these countries than originally thought. And so I think the news there is of concern, but hopeful, promising.
And do we feel that this, sort of the international sort of global health system has learned a lesson that maybe next time, you know, there will be vaccines, there'll be more preparation? I mean, it's not over. We shouldn't talk as if it's over. But is there a feeling here that we're sort of getting to grips with this a bit? The structures are being built?
I mean, I certainly hope so. And I think the fact that it so quickly reached American shores, I hope will be a sign to everybody that when this comes up and if a president wants to say to Americans, mm-hmm. this could affect you, give mm-hmm. me your support here, that he'll mm-hmm. be a lot easier selling that case and actually therefore getting involved in doing something.
Thank you. Well, that's all the time we have. And joining us today were Hillary Krieger, Deputy White House Editor at Politico, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor at National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.